Philanthrocapitalism. Gates has dubbed his foundation's operational philosophy philanthrocapitalism. Here is a stripped-down explanation of how philanthrocapitalism functions. Bill and Melinda Gates donated $36 billion of Microsoft stock to the BMGF between 1994 and 2020. Very early on, Gates created a separate entity, Bill Gates Investments, BGI, which manages his personal wealth and his foundation's corpus, renamed BMGI in January 2015 to include Melinda. The company predominantly invests that loot in multinational food, agriculture, pharmaceutical, energy, telecom, and tech companies with global operations. Federal tax laws require the BMGF to give away 7% of its foundation assets annually to qualify for tax exemption. Gates strategically targets BMGF's charitable gifts to give him control of the international health and agricultural agencies and the media, allowing him to dictate global health and food policies so as to increase profitability of the large multinationals in which he and his foundation hold large investment positions. Following such tactics, the Gates Foundation has given away some $54.8 billion since 1994, but instead of depleting his wealth, those strategic gifts have magnified it. Strategic philanthropizing increased the Gates Foundation's capital corpus to $49.8 billion by 2019. Moreover, Gates' personal net worth grew from $63 billion in 2000 to $133.6 billion today. Gates' wealth expanded by $23 billion just during the 2020 lockdowns that he and Dr. Fauci played key roles in orchestrating. In 2017, the Huffington Post observed that the Gates Foundation blurs the boundaries between philanthropy, business, and nonprofits, and cautions that calling Gates' investment strategy philanthropy was causing the rapid deconstruction of the accepted term. Gates' pharmaceutical investments are particularly relevant to this chapter. Since shortly after its founding, his foundation has owned stakes in multiple drug companies. A recent investigation by The Nation revealed that the Gates Foundation currently holds corporate stocks and bonds in drug companies like Merck, GSK, Eli Lilly, Pfizer, Novartis, and Sanofi. Gates also has heavy positions in Gilead, Biogen, AstraZeneca, Moderna, Novavax, and Inovio. The foundation's website candidly declares its mission to seek more effective models of collaboration with major vaccine manufacturers to better identify and pursue mutually beneficial opportunities. Gates and Fauci, colonizing the Dark Continent. After sealing their collaboration with a handshake, Gates and Dr. Fauci geared up their vaccine partnership quickly. By 2015, Gates was spending $400 million annually on AIDS drugs, mainly testing them on Africans. If he could prove that an AIDS remedy actually worked in Africa, the subsequent payoff from U.S. and European customers would be astronomical. For Gates, the immediate advantage of his new alliance with Dr. Fauci was clear. The imprimatur of his partnership with the U.S. government's premier public health khedive anointed Gates' public health experiments with credibility and gravitas. Moreover, Dr. Fauci was an international power broker controlling a gargantuan bankroll and wielding Brobdingnagian political wallop across Africa. A trusted presidential confidant, Dr. Fauci had made himself the indispensable rainmaker for the river of HIV funding flooding the African continent. Dr. Fauci had, by then, persuaded a succession of U.S. presidents to burnish their humanitarian bona fides by redirecting U.S. foreign aid away from the causes of nutrition, sanitation, and economic development, and toward solving Africa's HIV crisis with vaccines and drugs. His success in extracting a $15 billion commitment from George W. Bush in 2003 for AIDS drugs in Africa solidified Dr. Fauci's reputation as a global power broker capable of delivering U.S. dollars to any African potentate who cooperated with his AIDS enterprise. Despite his miserable track record at actually reducing illness over the next decade, he nevertheless persuaded President Bill Clinton in May 1997 to set a new national goal for science by making the cure for African AIDS his JFK moonshot promise. In a speech he delivered at Morgan State University, Clinton said, "Today, let us commit ourselves to developing an AIDS vaccine within the next decade." Largely due to Tony Fauci's influence, Clinton would squander billions of taxpayer dollars on this fruitless crusade during his presidency, and millions more of corporate and philanthropic contributions through the Clinton Foundation during his twilight years. George W. Bush similarly relied on Dr. Fauci's counsel, diverting $18 billion of the U.S. government's relatively anemic foreign aid contributions to Dr. Fauci's pet global AIDS projects between 2004 and 2008 alone. In 2008, the Journal of the European Molecular Biology Organization published a peer-reviewed article examining how the Gates-Fauci partnership had skewed NIH funding to reflect Gates's priorities, the grand impact of the Gates Foundation, $60 billion and one famous person can affect the spending and research focus of public agencies. That article showed how, following the Gates-Fauci handshake, NIH had shifted $1 billion to Gates's global vaccine programs at a time when overall NIH budget experienced little growth. The article outlines the technical details of the Gates-NIH partnership. The Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust funneled their donations through the NIH Foundation, which administers the money, while Gates determines how it is spent. In this way, Gates has cloaked his pet projects with the imprimatur and credibility of the United States government. He has effectively purchased himself an agency directorate. There is little objective evidence that all the treasure has extended or improved the lives of Africans, but every penny accrued to Fauci's reputation as Africa's foreign aid Golconda. When it came to public health policy in Africa, Dr. Fauci owned the keys to the kingdom. Gates needed Dr. Fauci to unlock the door. Citing Ralph Waldo Emerson's observation that charity can be a wicked dollar, sociology professor Lindsay McGoey explains that philanthropy can have evil effect when it places its beneficiaries under a boot rather than recognizing their equal right to foster their own independence, to realize their individuality. Professor McGoey is the author of the 2015 book, No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Profits of Philanthropy. Pharma had designs on Africa. Bwana Fauci and Bwana Gates donned pith helmets, grasped their machetes, shouldered their weaponized vaccines and toxic antivirals, and made themselves the 21st century versions of the crusading European explorers Burton and Speke, bestowing the blessings of Western civilization upon the dark continent and requiring only obedience in return. "They are here to save the world," says McGoey of philanthrocapitalists, "as long as the world yields to their interests." Thanks to their powerful collaboration, pharma would emerge as perhaps Africa's cruelest and most deadly colonial overlord. HIV provided Gates and Dr. Fauci a beachhead in Africa for their new brand of medical colonialism and a vehicle for the partners to build and maintain a powerful global network that came to include heads of state, health ministers, international health regulators, the WHO, the World Bank, the World Economic Forum, and key leaders from the financial industry and the military officials who served as command center of the burgeoning biosecurity apparatus. Their foot soldiers were the army of frontline virologists, vaccinologists, clinicians, and hospital administrators who relied on their largesse and acted as the community-based ideological commissars of this crusade. Philanthrocapitalism's Global Imperium. In August 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt forced Winston Churchill to sign the Atlantic Charter as a condition for U.S. support of the Allied effort in World War II. The Charter, a heartening emblem of American idealism, required the European allies to relinquish their colonies following the war. For two centuries, unimpeded access to the colonized world's rich national resources had been the principal source of European wealth. The Atlantic Charter and nationalist liberation movements in the 1950s and 60s dismantled the traditional colonial model in Africa. The continent, however, quickly reopened to soft colonization by multinational corporations and their state sponsors. During the Cold War, the U.S. military and intelligence agencies largely replaced Europe's colonial armies in those regions, supporting virtually any tin horn dictator who proved his anti-communist bona fides by rolling out red carpets for U.S. multinationals. When the Berlin Wall fell, the United States already had 655 military bases, now 800, across the developing world, and U.S. companies had blank checks in host nations to extract agricultural, mineral, petroleum, and lumber resources, and large markets for finished goods, including, notably, pharmaceuticals. After the Soviet bugaboo collapsed, Islamic terrorism and biosecurity supplanted communism as the rationale for a continued U.S. military and corporate presence all over the developing world. Pharma's acquisitive longing for Africa's natural resources and its teeming and compliant populations with their elevated disease burdens helped drive the rise of biosecurity as the spear tip of corporate imperialism. Bill Gates and Dr. Fauci offered biosecurity as the underlying rationale for their medical neocolonialism project. Paraphrasing the military's Cold War dogma, Gates and Dr. Fauci warned that if we didn't stop the germs in Africa, we'd end up fighting them in New York and Los Angeles. They echoed also the hackneyed crusaders' narrative that they were rescuing the continent from famine, pestilence, and ignorance with superior know-how and breakthrough technologies. The combined Gates-Fauci power to rain foreign aid dollars on capital-starved African governments made them modern imperial viceroys on the continent. WHO became their colonial vassal, legitimizing and facilitating their campaigns to open African markets for drug makers to dump unwanted products and to experiment with promising new cures. AIDS vaccines in Africa. In January 2003, as Gates and Dr. Fauci opened dozens of clinical trials for experimental AIDS vaccines across Africa, Dr. Fauci's perennial hagiographer Michael Spector, writing in The New Yorker, raised trenchant questions about the ethical problems associated with long-term vaccine trials in the developing world, funded by Western donors and designed largely by Western scientists. Spector asks, Has the race to save Africa from AIDS put Western science at odds with Western ethics? The article quotes African leaders asking why their continent needed to shoulder the burden of testing expensive vaccines and medicines that, if successful, would be primarily used in Western countries. They complained about pharmaceutical companies automatically lowering safety standards for clinical trials when they stepped onto the African continent. "Why us?" a prominent African journalist asked Spector. "It seems it's always us. For how many years does Uganda have to be the test case?" "I am very worried about these trials," said Peter Lurie, the deputy director of Public Citizens Health Research Group. Lurie and his colleague Sidney Wolfe complained to Spector about the cavalier attitude of American researchers toward third world subjects. Instead of seeing themselves as activists for better care in Africa, scientists will use the poor quality of care to justify what they want to do anyway, Lurie said. "But you are not permitted simply to use subjects in order to collect data because it is useful to you. That is exploitation and abuse. That is what Tuskegee was." Lurie was referring to CDC's notorious decision to leave hundreds of black Alabama sharecroppers with untreated syphilis for 40 years beginning in 1932, in order to document the course of the disease. "I am proud that my uncle, Senator Edward Kennedy, played a key role in exposing and ending the experiment in 1973. Lurie added, "If we aren't careful, we could be in for the greatest injustice in the history of medicine." Later that year, Dr. Fauci's agency announced that NIAID's most recent AIDS vaccine experiment had failed. "Please don't say that I am pessimistic, because I am not," Anthony Fauci said in 2003, obliquely conceding that HIV and AIDS were not behaving the way his hypotheses predicted. "The best ways to vaccinate don't work with HIV. We need to come up with something new." Gates seemed to think that floods of new money could teach the virus to behave. In July 2006, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announced 16 grants totaling $287 million to create an international network of collaborative research consortia focused on accelerating the pace of HIV vaccine development by funding more than 165 PIs to conduct vaccine trials in 19 countries. 2 years later, on July 18, 2008, Dr. Fauci announced the cancellation of the largest human trial to date. It was NIAID's most promising HIV vaccine by far. Dr. Fauci contributed $140 million of taxpayer money to develop the Merck jab, and NIAID had already begun enrolling 8,500 U.S. volunteers. It would be the first trial of an HIV jab on U.S. citizens. Dr. Fauci said he intended the new trial to determine whether the vaccine could significantly lower the amount of HIV in the blood of those who become infected. Of course, Merck and NIAID had already by then tested the vaccine on 3,000 participants in 9 African countries. The latest data were showing that the trial had not gone well. The Times reported coyly that the PAVE trial had been postponed after a test of the Merck vaccine failed in its 2 main objectives: to prevent infection and to lower the amount of HIV in the blood among those who became infected. Buried near the end of the New York Times article were some key facts. It turned out that the vaccine was not only ineffective, but researchers reported alarming safety signals that caused a safety monitoring committee to halt the study. Furthermore, instead of preventing infection, the Merck NIAID researchers reported data suggesting the vaccine actually raised the risk of contracting HIV. Dr. Fauci said he reached his decision to abort the coming trial after meeting with scientists trying to understand why the Merck vaccine malfunctioned. Dr. Fauci's colleagues could offer no explanation for the vaccine's failure. Lawrence K. Altman of the New York Times reported that Dr. Fauci admitted that after a decade of effort, scientists realized that they did not know enough about how HIV vaccines and the immune system interact. Dr. Fauci told the Times that it was becoming clearer that more fundamental research and animal testing would be needed before an HIV vaccine was ever marketed. These were stunning admissions, which seemed to validate the critiques by Duisberg and others who predicted the inevitable failure of a vaccine based on the defective HIV/AIDS hypothesis. Dr. Fauci said he had concluded that scientists must go a step at a time because they did not yet know fundamental facts like which immune reactions are the most important in preventing the infection. Cornell University scientist Kendall A. Smith made an even broader confession of error. "We really have not understood what actually constitutes a successful vaccine, despite the more than two centuries that have elapsed since Sir Edward Jenner described the first effective vaccine for smallpox virus in 1798. Consequently, all of the vaccines currently in use were developed empirically and only within the past 50 years without a comprehensive understanding as to how the immune system functions." If Fauci's HIV/AIDS hypotheses were true, they should have been able to develop a vaccine, observes Dr. David Rasnick, a Ph.D. biochemist who has worked for 30 years in the pharmaceutical biotech field. Fauci's fundamental conundrum is that he has told everybody to diagnose AIDS based on the presence of HIV antibodies. With every other disease, the presence of antibodies is the signal that the patient has vanquished the disease. With AIDS, Fauci and Gallo, and now Gates, claim it's a sign you're about to die. Think about it. If the objective of an AIDS vaccine is to stimulate antibody production, then success would mean that every vaccinated person would also have an AIDS diagnosis. I mean, this is fodder for a comedy bit. It's like someone gave the Three Stooges an annual billion-dollar budget. On October 8, 2015, Gallo's Institute of Human Virology at the University of Maryland School of Medicine announced the launch of its Phase 1 human trials of Gallo's latest HIV vaccine candidate. A consortium led by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave $23.4 million to Gallo's research on this vaccine. Other money came from Redfield's pals in the U.S. military HIV research program. Gallo launched his clinical trial in collaboration with Profectus Biosciences, a biotech firm that he recently spun off from IHV, to allow him to monetize the research he conducted with tax-deductible funding from Gates and taxpayer dollars from NIH and the military. Gallo had already been testing his new HIV vaccines on animals, and the results in monkeys are interesting, but they're not perfect. Undeterred by the vaccine's disappointing performance in macaques, Gallo was champing at the bit to test his concoction on some higher primates. "If we keep just using monkeys, we're never going anywhere. We need for humans to respond." In May 2020, I asked Gallo what had ever happened to this experimental vaccine. Gallo claimed, in what I suspected to be an evasive non-answer, that he was still, after 6 years, testing it for an immune response. By 2015, the BMGF was spending about $400 million a year on AIDS drug research. Gallo told me that his is only one of over 100 groups Gates has funded to find the elusive vaccine. Gates admitted publicly to Agence France-Presse that the quest for an AIDS vaccine has taken longer than expected, with many disappointments along the way. Despite Gates and Fauci's impressive string of failures, Gates remained bullish. "A vaccine, that's a big area of funding for our foundation, but even in the best case, that's 5 years away, and perhaps as long as 10, he jauntily predicted, during a question-and-answer session with young people. Probably the top priority is a vaccine. If we had a vaccine that can protect people, we can stop the epidemic. On February 3, 2020, Julie Steenhuisen of Reuters reported that NIAID had suddenly halted its clinical trial of its most promising HIV vaccine to date. NIAID was in the middle of phase 3 trials on more than 5,000 South Africans when they realized that once again, the vaccine was raising the risk of AIDS in vaccinated individuals. Dr. Fauci issued another of his cheerful prognostications. Research continues on other approaches to a safe and effective HIV vaccine, which I still believe can be achieved. Since 1984, undeterred by 37 years of broken promises, failed clinical trials, billions of squandered dollars, and uncounted human carnage, Dr. Fauci and his old crony Bob Gallo continue to ride the AIDS vaccine gravy train. Neither man has advanced the search for a cure, but both have built impressive institutions. Existential questions about their scientific validity still bedeviled the two intertwined disciplines of virology and vaccinology, for which those institutions form key nerve centers. Dr. Fauci's battle against AIDS is a religious crusade rooted in faith and appeals to authority, rather than empiricism or rigorous scientific proof. Following the path of earlier colonial interventions in Africa, Dr. Fauci's evangelical campaign to impose the orthodoxies of germ warfare on Africans is an exercise in raw power, domination, and the ruthless extraction of profit. Virology, a new Janissary Corps. As with the sultans, khans, czars, monarchs, and emperors of yore, Dr. Fauci's power derives from his capacity to fund, arm, pay, maintain, and effectively deploy a large and sprawling standing army. NIH alone controls an annual $42 billion budget, mainly distributed in over 50,000 grants supporting over 300,000 positions globally in medical research. The thousands of doctors, hospital administrators, health officials, and research virologists whose positions, careers, and salaries depend on AIDS dollars flowing from Dr. Fauci, Mr. Gates, and the Wellcome Trust, Great Britain's version of the Gates Foundation, are the officers and soldiers in a mercenary army that functions to defend all vaccines and Dr. Fauci's HIV/AIDS doxologies. The entire field of virology is Dr. Fauci's Janissary Corps, the elite warriors that he can rapidly muster to each new battlefield to achieve new conquests and ruthlessly suppress rebellion, dissent, and resistance. In 2020, many of the Gates-Fauci HIV vaccine trials in Africa suddenly became COVID-19 vaccine trials, as the unprecedented tsunami of new COVID-19 plunder began flowing through Dr. Fauci to the same disciplined legions of the virology caste. At the outset of the pandemic, Dr. Fauci tapped his trusty procurator, Dr. Larry Corey, to launch the COVID-19 Prevention Network with the purpose of redeploying Dr. Fauci's most reliable and trusted PIs on a blitzkrieg campaign to win lightning vaccine approvals for his preferred jabs. Fauci accomplished this daunting mission by transforming his existing HIV trials practically overnight into Phase 3 COVID-19 vaccine trials. Without breaking stride, his PI army pivoted to march in lockstep into the new viral skirmish. Their exquisitely disciplined ranks also supplied the independent experts who populated the FDA and CDC committees that approved those shoddily tested COVID pokes the doctors and medical ethicists who appeared on TV to run interference for every government-mandated COVID-19 countermeasure. Masks, lockdowns, social distancing, and vaccination, including justifying the jab for children and pregnant women. In any rational universe, giving these untested, low-efficacy shots to children and pregnant women would constitute both medical malpractice and child abuse, given the low risk for COVID and higher risk from the vaccine among these cohorts. They penned editorials in the newspapers and articles in the scientific journals validating official orthodoxies and uniformly dismissing dissenters as screwballs, flakes, quacks, and conspiracy theorists. From their ranks, Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates tapped the charlatans and biostitutes who conducted the fraudulent studies that torpedoed hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and won approval for their pet blockbuster drug, remdesivir. When revelations that the COVID-19 virus was likely the product of genetic engineering threatened to discredit his empire, Tony Fauci dispatched the hand-picked elite of virology's officer corps to draft and sign the consequential editorials published in Nature and The Lancet in February and March of 2020, assuring the world that the lab leak hypothesis was a crackpot conspiracy. The monolithic discipline of the virology caste and its capacity to rigorously enforce its omerta effectively silenced debate on COVID-19's origins for a year. The saga of Fauci virologist Christian Anderson, a PI who built his career on serial NIAID grants, offers a stark example of Fauci's system of payoffs. Anderson was the first grantee to alert Tony Fauci in a 10:32 p.m. email on January 31, 2020, to the strong evidence that COVID-19 was lab-generated and that the experiment that created it may bear NIAID's fingerprints. After midnight, Dr. Fauci warned his chief aide to keep his phone on and stand ready for some important work, to arrange a secretive emergency meeting to discuss damage control with 11 of the world's top virologists, including Anderson and 5 key researchers from the Wellcome Trust. Dr. Fauci was the only U.S. government official on this phone call. 4 days later, Anderson, who less than 100 hours earlier was convinced the virus did not come from nature, submitted a letter, secretly edited by Fauci, signed by 5 prominent virologists, all NIAID and Wellcome Trust PIs, ridiculing the suggestion that the circulating coronavirus could possibly have been lab-generated. 1 month later, Dr. Fauci, without disclosing his secretive involvement, cited that very letter at a White House press conference as proof that COVID-19 was naturally evolved. In the months that followed, Anderson's employer, Scripps Research Institute, received an array of substantial grants from NIAID totaling $78 million for the calendar year. The NIAID, by the end of 2020, had granted the employers of 4 of the 5 signatories on the paper a total of nearly $155 million. That's how the game gets played. Dr. Fauci's disciples and soldiers understand that as long as they support Dr. Fauci, they will continue to benefit from the endless stream of public health booty he controls, their spoils from the war on germs and on skeptics. HIV vaccines, a new lease on life. In March 2020, Bill Gates stepped down from his position on the board of directors at Microsoft, explaining that he was now spending the predominant amount of his time on the pandemic. Gates celebrated his Microsoft retirement by directing a river of money to build 6 manufacturing plants for different COVID vaccines and funding vaccine trials by companies like Inovio Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca, and Moderna, Inc., all front-runners in the race to develop a COVID-19 jab. The Gates Foundation also invested $480 million in a wide range of vaccine candidates and platform technologies through the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, CEPI, which Gates founded with Wellcome Trust Director Jeremy Farrar. Tony Fauci, meanwhile, took over managing the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The two men played tag team on the evening news and Sunday talk shows to promote remdesivir and to let their obsequious hosts and the American people know that the only way to end the global hostage crisis was compliance by 7 billion people with their new vaccines. No one ever questioned Gates's mantric pronouncement, which he repeated like a Gregorian chant. Realistically, if we're going to return to normal, we need to develop a safe, effective vaccine. We need to make billions of doses. We need to get them out to every part of the world, and we need all of this to happen as quickly as possible. He reiterated versions of this message ad nauseum, as he did again on CNN on March 22, 2020. Things won't be back to truly normal until we have a vaccine that we've gotten out to basically the entire world. Back to HIV. But despite all the excitement about COVID, neither of these partners forgot their first love, AIDS. On February 9, 2021, with his Operation Warp Speed vaccine rollout approaching the finish line, Dr. Tony Fauci took a well-earned breather to make an exciting announcement. He told his giddy media acolytes that NIH had just committed to a $200 million joint initiative with the Gates Foundation to fund the next generation of AIDS vaccines using NIAID's new mRNA technology. This collaboration is an ambitious step forward, harnessing the most cutting-edge scientific tools and NIH's sizable global HIV research infrastructure to one day deliver a cure and end the global HIV pandemic. Ignoring 40 years of abysmal failure, NIH Director Francis S. Collins, MD, PhD, who plays Robin to Dr. Fauci's Batman, added, "We aim to go big or go home." That thrilling announcement occurred almost exactly 40 years after the first report of AIDS. After four decades of cataclysmic outcomes, billions of squandered dollars, untold lives lost, and failed promises, the press corps gave this most recent production the same rapt and credulous applause with which they greeted Teflon Tony's 100 other indistinguishable pronouncements over four decades. He is the P.T. Barnum of public health, Marvel's journalist Celia Farber. He cracks his whip and says abracadabra, and they all forget that they've seen the same trick so many times. It's really quite astonishing. By then, the Fauci-Gates arsenal of COVID pokes were topping the all-time charts for medical money-making by their pharma partners, with Pfizer alone projecting $96 billion in COVID vaccine sales. Moderna followed up Dr. Fauci's appearance with a press release announcing new mRNA vaccines for Zika, Ebola, flu, cancer, and HIV. On July 25, 2021, Dr. Fauci expanded on this exciting communique by announcing a new multi-billion-dollar government initiative to use taxpayer money and NIAID-patented mRNA technology to prepare distinct new vaccines for 20 families of viruses that might spark future pandemics. Dr. Fauci disclosed that he was already in discussions with the Biden White House about his electrifying proposal, which he said will cost a few billion dollars on top of NIAID's existing $6 billion budget. He said he planned to launch the project in 2022. Dr. Collins said he found Dr. Fauci's proposal compelling, scolding that As we begin to contemplate a successful end to the COVID-19 pandemic, we must not slip back into complacency. On September 2, 2021, Joe Biden came through for Dr. Fauci again, announcing a $65 billion pandemic response effort. Dr. Fauci will be its point man. Biden's announcement eclipsed some sad news. On August 31, 2021, Dr. Fauci acknowledged their premature termination of yet another of his African HIV vaccine experiments. A large trial on 2,600 African girls of a Johnson & Johnson HIV jab, funded jointly by NIAID and the Bill & Melinda Gates Foundation, had failed to demonstrate a beneficial effect. The heartbreaking legacy of medical colonialism. Rudyard Kipling originally coined the term white man's burden in his 1897 poem exhorting the moral imperative of the United States and England to impose Western civilizations and Christianity on tribal peoples for their own good. Every student of African history is familiar with the recurring theme of well-intentioned white men visiting calamity on Africans. My interest in Africa began as a child. I have traveled the continent for 6 decades and met some of its most visionary leaders, including Tom Mboya, Jomo Kenyatta, Julius Nyerere, and Nelson Mandela. These anti-colonial leaders understood that poverty is a complex conspiracy of social, historical, political, institutional, and technical maladies. It is most often best addressed through small-scale, locally tailored trial-and-error experimentation. The optimal solutions are invariably homegrown with regular local input, disciplined self-assessment, accountability, frequent course corrections, and lots of humility by administrators, officials, and above all, foreigners. Gates's HIV vaccine and antiviral program is due to its continent-wide scale, arguably the worst in a long parade of paternalistic Western schemes by imperialists, avaricious adventurers, scammers, schemers, charlatans, double-dealing rogues, and well-meaning dolts who regularly pledge to end African suffering. Instead of approaching Africa with humility, curiosity, open ears, and a willingness to support local initiatives, Gates leads with the same Weisenheimer arrogance that Judge Penfield Jackson pegged as Gates's defining character trait in his 1998 ruling. At best, Gates and Dr. Fauci are just the latest in a long line of crusaders, con artists, and conquistadors who periodically appear on the continent, armed with the conviction that they know what's best for Africans. Too often, these are self-serving, one-size-fits-all vanity projects that, in the end, only compound calamity and magnify suffering. At worst, in the words of Loffredo and Greenstein, Gates and his foundation function as a Trojan horse for Western corporations, which of course have no goal greater than an increased bottom line. The foundation appears to see the Global South as both a dumping ground for drugs deemed too unsafe for the developed world and a testing ground for drugs not yet determined to be safe enough for the developed world. Magical vaccines are Gates's preeminent cookie-cutter solution for the ills of poverty, famine, drought, and disease. The absurdity of expensive shots as a remedy for indigence, a salve for malnutrition, or the dearth of potable water is obvious when one considers that 3 billion people live on less than $2 per day. 840 million people don't have enough to eat. 1 billion lack clean water or access to sanitation. 1 billion are illiterate. About a quarter of children in poor countries do not finish primary school. Poverty is a target-rich environment, but the data suggests that Gates's vaccines miss the target altogether. Sociologist Lindsay McGoey quotes a young health researcher based at the University of Cape Coast on Western Ghana. From my point of view, it's more like the Gates Foundation are selling technology than solving problems. Most of their calls have to do with developing some new technology or vaccines. How Gates controls the WHO. Worst, Gates has used his money strategically to infect the international aid agencies with his distorted self-serving priorities. The United States historically has been the largest direct donor to WHO with a contribution of $604.2 million in 2018 through 2019, the last years for which numbers are available. That year, BMGF gave $431.3 million and Gavi gave $316.5 million. Plus, Gates also routes funding to WHO through SAGE and UNICEF and Rotary International, bringing his cumulative total contributions to over $1 billion, making Gates the unofficial top sponsor of the WHO, even before the Trump administration's 2020 move to cut all his support to the organization. Those $1 billion tax-deductible donations give Gates leverage and control over WHO's $5.6 billion budget and over international health policy, which he largely directs to serve the profit interest of his pharma partners. Pharmaceutical companies cement WHO's institutional bias toward vaccines with approximately $70 million of their own direct contributions. "Our priorities are your priorities," Gates declared in 2011. In 2012, WHO's then Director General Margaret Chan complained that because the WHO's budget is highly earmarked, it is driven by what she calls donor interests. According to McGoey, according to its charter, the WHO is meant to be accountable to member governments. The Gates Foundation, on the other hand, is accountable to no one other than its three trustees, Bill, Melinda, and Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett. Many civil society organizations fear the WHO's independence is compromised when a significant portion of its budget comes from a private philanthropic organization with the power to stipulate exactly where and how the UN institution spends its money. McGoey observes that virtually every significant decision at WHO is first vetted by the Gates Foundation. As the UK-based NGO Global Justice Now told Grey Zone, the foundation's influence is so pervasive that many actors in international development, which would otherwise critique the policy and practice of the foundation, are unable to speak out independently as a result of its funding and patronage. See also The Perils of Philanthrocapitalism, Eric Franklin Amirante, Maryland Law Review, 2018. Gates's vaccine obsession has diverted WHO's giving away from poverty alleviation, nutrition, and clean water to make vaccine uptake its preeminent public health metric. And Gates is not afraid to throw his weight around. In 2011, Gates spoke at the WHO, ordering that all 193 member states, you must make vaccines a central focus of your health systems. The following year, the World Health Assembly, which sets the WHO agenda, adopted a global vaccine plan that the Gates Foundation co-authored. Over half of WHO's total budget now goes to vaccines. That narrow focus on inoculations is deepening Africa's health crisis, according to global health experts and African officials. Their control of several billion dollars in annual inputs gives Gates and Fauci effective control over not only WHO, but also the retinue of authoritative quasi-governmental agencies that Gates, often with Fauci's assistance and support, created and/or funded, including CEPI, Gavi, PATH, UNITAID, UNICEF, SAGE, the Global Development Program, the Global Fund, the Brighton Collaboration, and governmental health ministries in dozens of African nations that are largely dependent on the WHO and other global health partnerships. A 2017 analysis of the 23 global health partnerships revealed that 7 were entirely dependent on Gates funding, and another 9 listed the foundation as its top donor. The Gates Foundation also controls the Strategic Advisory Group of Experts, SAGE, the principal advisory group to the WHO for vaccines. During a recent meeting, half of SAGE's governing board of 15 people listed conflicts of interest with the Gates Foundation. The most powerful of these groups is Gavi, the second largest non-state funder of the WHO. Gates created Gavi as a public-private partnership that facilitates bulk sales of vaccines from his pharma partners to poor countries. Gavi is the template for Gates's impressive capacity to use his celebrity, credibility, and wealth to mesmerize key public officials and heads of state into giving Gates control over their foreign aid spending. Gates launched Gavi in 1999 with a $750 million donation. The BMGF occupies a permanent seat on the Gavi board. Other organizations that Gates controls or can rely upon, WHO, UNICEF, the World Bank, and the pharmaceutical industry occupy additional seats, giving Gates dictatorial authority over Gavi's decision-making. The BMGF has donated a total of $4.1 billion to Gavi to date. But Gates has used that relatively trivial contribution, and his personal charm, I suppose, to attract over $16 billion from government and private donors, including $1.16 billion annually from the U.S. government, 5 times the amount that Gates donates to the WHO. When President Trump withdrew the United States from WHO in 2020, he continued the U.S. contribution of $1.16 billion to Gavi. The cumulative effect, therefore, of the withdrawal was to increase Gates's power over WHO and over global health policy. A recent assessment of Gavi by British Prime Minister Boris Johnson offers potent testimony of Gates's capacity to inspire the sort of obsequious adulation that has prompted Western leaders to hand over foreign policy and vast hoards of taxpayer dollars to Gates's discretion. In August 2021, Johnson declared that Gavi was the new NATO. Switzerland, which hosts Gavi's global headquarters in Geneva, has granted Gates's group full diplomatic immunity, a privilege Switzerland denies to many nations and their diplomats. Additionally, the sheer magnitude of his foundation's financial contributions has made Bill Gates an unofficial, albeit unelected, leader of the WHO. By 2017, Gates's power was so complete that he handpicked his deputy, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, as the WHO's new director general, despite complaints that Tedros would be the first director general to the WHO without a medical degree, and despite Tedros's dubious background. Critics credibly charged Tedros with running a terror group associated with extreme human rights violations, including genocidal policies against a rival tribal group in Ethiopia. As Ethiopia's foreign minister, Tedros aggressively suppressed freedom of speech, including arresting and jailing journalists who criticized his party's policies. Tedros's key qualification for the WHO gig was his loyalty to Gates. Tedros previously served on the boards of 2 organizations that Gates founded, funded, and controls, Gavi and the Global Fund, where Tedros was Gates' trusted chair of the board. Gavi is the most tangible outcome of the partnership Gates sealed with Fauci in early 2000. Under the terms of the partnership, Dr. Fauci greenhouses a pipeline of new vaccines in NIAID labs and farms them out for cultivation in clinical trials by his university PIs and the pharmaceutical multinationals in which Gates holds high investment stakes. Gates then builds out supply chains and creates innovative financial devices for guaranteeing those companies' markets in third world countries. A key feature of this scheme is Gates' capacity, through WHO, to pressure developing countries to expedite and purchase the vaccine, and to use Gavi as a bank through which wealthy countries co-sign the debt. Western nations once funneled their foreign aid through traditional NGOs for food and economic development. Gates has captured those deal flows for Gavi and his pharma partners by pressuring Western countries to fork over their foreign aid to Gavi. Gates thereby hijacks the foreign assistance monies from wealthy governments, diverting it to drug makers. In May 2012, following two meetings with Gavi's CEO, Dr. Seth Berkley, Fauci candidly described the close relationship between Gavi and NIH. "We, NIH, work on the upstream component of the fundamental research development. Gavi develops a vaccine and gets it into the arms of people who need them." Dr. Fauci explained that while NIH is way up in the upstream and Gavi is way down in the downstream, there is no daylight between Gates's organization and his agency. "There are areas of synergy and outright collaboration between us in setting the standard of what is needed and what kinds of research questions are important to answer. We don't want to be putting resources, particularly in the developing world, if the research isn't going to be implemented, particularly with cold chain concerns." Gavi is much more of a visible, coordinated force now, with a lot of resources, working in many, many countries, in contrast to some of the less reliable African governments. It's an organization you can deal directly with. Western nations originally conceived the World Health Organization and the United Nations to embody liberal ideologies implemented via a democratic structure of one nation, one vote, India's leading human rights activist, Dr. Vandana Shiva, told me. Gates has single-handedly destroyed all that. He has hijacked the WHO and transformed it into an instrument of personal power that he wields for the cynical purpose of increasing pharmaceutical profits. He has single-handedly destroyed the infrastructure of public health globally. He has privatized our health systems and our food systems to serve his own purposes. As Jeremy Lofrido and Michelle Greenstein concede in their July 2020 article, the Gates Foundation has already effectively privatized the international body charged with creating health policy, transforming it into a vehicle for corporate dominance. It has facilitated the dumping of toxic products onto the people of the global south, and even used the world's poor as guinea pigs for drug experiments. The Gates Foundation's influence over public health policy is practically contingent on ensuring that safety regulations and other government functions are weak enough to be circumvented. It therefore operates against the independence of nation-states and as a vehicle for Western capital.